If you haven't heard, we're doing it big on Thursday, October 3rd in Los Angeles. That's the date for the Trapital Summit. This is the first summit that Trapital is hosting, and this is going to be the place for the innovators, the builders, and the visionaries that are pushing music and entertainment forward. We have a curated lineup of some of the top leaders in the industry that are doing things big, and they're going to be joining us for fireside chat conversations. You'll hear from Issa Rae, Tunji Balogun from Def Jam, Troy Carter from Venice Music, Kakul Srivastava from Splice, Charisse Clark Suarez from Harborview Equity Partners, Denis Ladegiri from Believe, Elias Seaton from SoundCloud, and more. I am really excited about this, and the thing I'm really excited about is that we're doing things a little bit differently. We've all been to the conferences where there's so many people on stage, so many people that are at the panel. You want to hear from some of them a lot more than others, but no, we're keeping the bar high and we're having deep conversations and real conversations with the people that are actually making moves in this industry. So you can get your tickets now. Tickets are on sale now. You can click the link in our show notes that bring you directly to the website. And anyone listening to this episode can get a 10% discount. Use the code RUNCIE. That's my last name. That's RUNCIE. And get 10% off your ticket. This is going to be a dope event. I'm really excited about it. And I hope you are too. See you there. Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. When I look back at some of the most popular breakdowns that we've done in Trapital, like Issa Rae or Tyler Perry or Will and Jada Pinkett Smith, there's one person that they often look to as the inspiration and the source for where their ideas come from, and that's Oprah Winfrey. The way that she was able to change the game in media and entertainment is something that we hadn't seen before and likely won't see again, at least not in the same way. Oprah proved that you could have a massively popular show like the Oprah Winfrey Show that was running for 25 years, but also participate in the ownership of that show and the economics to go from someone that would have earned a healthy six-figure salary to earning hundreds of millions of dollars thereafter. It was a show that made her a billionaire, and it's why she's the focus for this episode and our latest installment of One of Ones. We talk about Oprah's early years, those early struggles she had, and how that set the stage for her to have her career in broadcast journalism. But then we also talk about her starting the daytime talk show and her early film career in The Color Purple and other films, and how that set the stage for her to have the massive success that she had, and how it set the stage for the Oprah effect, the influence on product sales, on politics, and a whole lot more. Today, I'm joined by Zach O'Malley-Greenberg, friend of the pod, to break it all down, where we talk about the early years, the Oprah Winfrey years, the OWN network, the deals with CBS and Discovery, Apple, and a whole lot more. This episode was a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's dive in. All right. Today, we have a breakdown on a true one of one, and that's Oprah Winfrey. And I'm joined by Zach Greenberg, friend of the pod. Welcome back, man.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here as always.
Has there ever been a better influencer than Oprah? I know that isn't what she's known for, but thinking about her influence, has there been a better influencer than Oprah Winfrey?
That's a good one. Does Obama count as an influencer? Also, Oprah, I think, would have more people who would not have voted for Obama under her influence. So,
true.
Yeah, I can't come up with an easy one. Certainly, I can't think of anyone that's been bigger.
Before you continue, we'd like to pause and give you a quick heads up about the next 3 minutes of the conversation, because we talk about some very sensitive topics, including child abuse and sexual assault. And given the gravity of the discussion, if you'd rather skip ahead and avoid that, you could fast forward around 3 minutes from this particular point. But if not, you can continue listening on from here. Thank you. She's touched so much, had so much influence, all different types of media, all different types of entertainment. We can start off a little bit just by highlighting a few of the things in her early years. And I think one of the things that makes Oprah truly unique is she wasn't someone that had a lot growing up. She grew up in the depths of poverty. She grew up with her grandparents. Her mother had her when she was 14. She was raised in a house that didn't have indoor plumbing. And then, sadly, there was also a lot of sexual abuse there as well. She was raped by one of her 19-year-old cousins when she was 9 years old, and she was also raped by an uncle, by a family friend. And a lot of those experiences also led to her own
sexual promiscuity. She was pregnant herself at 14 years old. She gave birth to a child that had only survived just a month, that was born prematurely. So there was quite a bit there that was tough. And if you had to look at the odds of that and say, yes, this person is going to become one of the richest women in the entire world, at that particular point, how could you even fathom that, just given the influence? So it just makes everything else that she's done in her life so much more remarkable. But still, looking through that backstory was just incredibly sad to revisit.
Yeah, we talk about the quote-unquote rags to riches story, the American dream, making something from nothing. But I don't think you could design a more difficult circumstance to rise up from than Oprah had, in every possible facet, from personal side of it to the financial side of it, the whole package. So it's just miraculous to just live a stable life coming out of that at all. And then to think about the heights to which she's risen, all the barriers that she smashed on top of that, that she had to smash even after going through her childhood. I don't think we can think of many who've risen to these heights coming from any backgrounds. When you add it all up, talk about a one of one, that's Oprah.
Definitely. And looking at that experience for her, especially after giving birth to that child that didn't survive, it was a family member of hers that said to her, hey, this could be a turning point for your own life as well. And it was definitely some tough phrasing there, but she took that and really lived it. She started getting involved with speech competitions and these oration competitions. When she was in high school, she got involved with student government as well. She was a class VP. She also started participating in beauty pageants. She was Miss Black Tennessee. She won a Miss Local Fire Prevention contest as well. And this was actually one of her earlier points, getting noticed by people hearing her speak and being surprised that she could speak so well. But she's someone that learned to read early. She was reading at church, and she would repeat the things that she would hear from the scriptures and sermons at church in a lot of these places. And that landed to her first broadcast gig. And that's another common thing we see. People that are starting these things as teenagers, they're getting their early experience. This is what she's been doing now for her entire career.
Just again, remarkable, but I got to go back to Miss Fire Prevention. Well, I really want to know what that entails. And are there other kinds of designations, like for other civic kind of duties there? And where does it rank in the hierarchy of pageants and other things? I don't know if that'd be my first question for Oprah, but if I had a whole bunch of questions, I would really like to learn more about what the duties of Miss Fire Prevention entailed.
Right. I'm thinking like a Smokey the Bear, only you can protect forest fires. I'm thinking of someone.
Yeah. So just flagging that for all the government officials listening here.
At this point, though, this is when she gets heard after winning that Miss Local Fire Prevention contest, and she gets a job at WVOL. That's a local Nashville radio station, and she gets a on-air broadcasting job there. And at this point, she graduates from East Nashville High School, and she then starts going to Tennessee State University, and she starts working there at the radio station at school, and she's continuing her broadcast career. Then she gets noticed by some CBS affiliates that hear her on air and say, hey, do you want to come in and be part of our on-screen TV program? And she goes to her professor and she's like, I don't want to leave school to do this thing. I'm still in school. Should I do this? And her professor's like, what? Like, the whole reason you're in school is so you can get job opportunities like this that you have. You need to go take that job opportunity. So at 19 years old, Oprah goes and takes the job at the CBS local affiliate. And then that is her first time being on air. And she becomes the first Black female for the station to be on air and have her be part of the main broadcast for the show.
Absolutely. And also worth noting, the pay at that time, $22,000 a year. She's improved considerably on the pay front since then. Although, to be fair, in inflation adjusted dollars, that's probably around $160,000. But compared to where she got, just again, the journey is absolutely incredible. But I guess also coming from where she came from, having a full-time job and a salary of any kind, it must have been just absolutely life-changing. Yeah, I don't know. I looked at that inflation calculator BLS.gov. I think some of it gets a little funky with the 70s, and there were some weird economic things happening there. But in any case, $22,000 went a lot further than it does now, but still nothing compared to what she's making currently.
Agreed. So she has that role, and this is where she's evening anchor, and she sees this and she's like, I am trying to be Barbara Walters. She is definitely trying to emulate that as best as she can. She says she still didn't feel quite natural in what she did, but this was her opportunity to be on camera, be on stage. And one of the things she said was she felt that being a reporter in this type of way was more scripted than she would have liked. It felt a bit more rehearsed. It felt a bit more difficult to be her natural self, but she eventually takes this opportunity and then moves from Nashville to Baltimore, where she does get further primetime opportunities to be able to be on the evening anchor there, where it's her and another co-host that have the program there. But that was actually a short-lived opportunity, because after a year, at this point, she's 22, almost 23 years old, she then gets demoted to weekend features, where she's talking about cockatoo birthday parties and talking about less important things. And for Oprah, someone that from her career, we just talked so much about her successes, there were a few setbacks. And this is one of the early ones that made her pause and reflect and say, huh, what do I really want out of this?
Yeah. And it makes you think a little bit also about the structure of journalistic outlets back in the day. Back then, before social media, before classifieds, all those ad dollars were in legacy media. And that led to more specialized jobs. You had reporters and writers that were not necessarily the same job and would go on to many different layers of editing, each editor having their own specialty, right? You know, baking these very elaborate cakes for somebody like Oprah, who's the complete package. If you're only baking one part of that cake instead of being the whole cake, I could see how you might not be used to the best of your abilities.
Yeah. And I think it was tough for her. That demotion ended up working out for her, because the weekend features led to this role where she was the co-host of this show called People Are Talking. And that was a much more relaxed environment where she was able to be a bit more of herself and talk about these human interest stories. And she felt like she really had her calling there in a lot of ways. And even though she was still trying to mimic a bit of the Barbara Walters thing, not that that's too much of a surprise. We know that a lot of people often imitate people before they find their own style. But this is also one of the first places where, even though Oprah was making relatively good money at the time, she started to see that disconnect between her and others, because she realized that her co-host was making a lot more than she was. But she had heard that her co-host has kids and he has a mortgage and he has a family, and because of that, we need to pay him more. And she's, wait, what? Why does that have anything to do with the performance? So she didn't put up a big fight about it then, but it was one of those mental notes for her that she then makes. And she's like, okay, noted. I will revisit this when the time is right.
Absolutely. And is that really the reason? Is that really the reason why? I think there's some other more nefarious factors at play, but obviously they weren't going to tell her that.
Indeed. The other thing we should talk about too, the time that People Are Talking started to hit off was when daytime talk show television was really starting to be a thing. And Phil Donahue was the man. He was the person that had the show, very popular in the 80s, very popular in the 70s too. Whether you're a stay-at-home parent or you're watching TV during the day, he was that main person connecting. And People Are Talking actually started to get better ratings in Baltimore, which is a local market that it was in, than Donahue was, because Donahue was being syndicated in Baltimore as many other markets at the time too. So this is when the King World Media Rights Distribution and Syndication Company were able to syndicate the People Are Talking show from the ABC affiliate in Baltimore to these other markets. They got in 17 other markets. It didn't quite take off at that time, but this was the type of thing that paved the way for her. But with that, we should talk a little bit more, because I think this moment of daytime television in general speaks a lot to Oprah being able to have the success that she was able to have in the 80s coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's easy for people to think of daytime TV as an afterthought now. Yeah, first of all, people don't really have cable anymore, right? I'm an old man. I want my baseball, so I have cable. So right, sometimes I'm eating lunch, I'm working at home, I'll just flick through for 20 minutes while I eat my lunch. And it's hot garbage on daytime TV now. It's like glorified infomercials, like trashy soap operas. Nothing interesting is happening on daytime TV. But obviously that wasn't the case back in the 80s and before. And daytime was this big thing because what are people doing on their lunch breaks? What are people doing? Parents working at home. What do you do on a sick day? And there's this tremendous culture of sitting down and watching TV or having it on in the background. And some of the big shows in daytime TV, that's where some of the top earners in entertainment are coming from the Donahues of the world down to The Price is Right. It's not like a place you retire into, a soft landing for a celebrity that people don't really know what to do with. It was more of a hot space. So I think it's important to remember that as we continue talking about it.
The closest comparison I can think of today is getting a 9-figure podcast deal from a tech company.
Interesting. Yeah. That definitely matches up. Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Right. But assuming that this is their full-time job that they're doing, and right. It's not just a group of actors that are doing this during the writer's strike or something. And with that came the bigger opportunities. So even though the syndication from People Are Talking didn't quite work out, it led her to move from Baltimore to Chicago. And even though Oprah is so synonymous with Chicago, it's easy to forget that isn't where her broadcast career started, but at least this is where she was able to continue things. And she was hired to host AM Chicago, which was the daytime talk show there. And she again was going straight head to head with Donahue, and they started beating the ratings for Donahue in Chicago, one of the biggest media markets in the country. So this was no longer just a local thing. They were doing it on a massive level. And at this point, Oprah was being paid a pretty solid salary. She was getting paid $230,000, and they were in talks for her renegotiation for the contract as well. This is with her and her agent that were talking about things with ABC and others at the time. And the way that the contract was initially structured was going to be $230,000 at first, and then there would be a $30,000 a year increase for the next 4 years of the contract. So not too long after, she'd be making over $300,000 in 1984 numbers, which is huge, right?
You can basically triple those numbers to get an idea of what they would be today in terms of buying power, inflation adjusted, and all that. Yeah, that's a pretty incredible setup to begin with.
Yeah. She says, okay, let me pause, because she starts to hear feedback from a few different people about how much the people at the network love her agent. They say, oh, he's so great. He's so great. And then she's like, wait, if you all think that he's great, does that mean that he is aggressive enough with these types of contracts? Because it's funny now that in pop culture, we see so many aggressive agents that are notorious for Drew Rosenhaus or Ari Emanuel or even Ari Gold, the fictional version of it on Entourage. But she had an agent that was too nice. She was like, no, we need to take a step back. So she finds this agent. I forget his first name, but his last name was Jacobs, who's more known for being a piranha, teams up with King's World, and they set up Oprah Business Foundation Empire. Their big thing is that, hey, we don't want to give away the syndication rights that you would and just collect the upfront salary. You need to get those syndication rights yourself and then sell those individually to the different markets the same way that King World does. And we'll do it in tandem where King World can get a cut, because everything after that is they're not taking on any cost for the work that they're doing as opposed to the time that's put into it. And on Oprah's side, she's laying the groundwork for her to eventually start Harpo Studios to then bring the production in-house. But even before she brings the production in-house, she gets the syndication deals up front. She gets that where she's then getting the incremental revenue plus a share of 1 minute of ad revenue that comes in from each of the networks for each of their massive distribution they have. And especially in Atlanta, Houston, some of these massive markets, it's huge. And that's when Oprah goes from making a healthy $200,000 to $300,000 salary to bringing in $115 million in the first 2 years of her show after that deal is in place.
Quite a step up, and it only went up from there. When you think about it, the whole way that syndication works, it's so different from the current state of affairs. You mentioned before the equivalent of a 9-figure big tech content deal, right? The Netflix model right now, let's say, call it the Netflix model. There's some big deal. And then the content goes out on Netflix, and that's the distribution, right? You cut out the middleman, basically. But in the US, the way things evolved, you had your content creators, you had your networks, and then they had their local affiliates, and you had to sell out to all of them. It's like a much more involved process, and it's some more barriers to entry. But if you could, like Oprah did, take control of some of that process, then the rewards could be immense. And that's exactly what she did.
And this is still a pretty small operation, Harpo Studios. So it's Oprah and 4 or 5 other people working for her that are coming up with these stories, coming up with these interviews, coming up with the programming. Of course, they had the partnerships in place, but the amount of revenue that they were able to generate from a show that had pretty low production costs, it's pretty impressive what she's able to do. And two, we should talk a bit about her style, because this is one of the reasons why AM Chicago, People Are Talking, and now the Oprah Winfrey Show were able to take off. Oprah was willing to take a step back and think about connecting with the audience. It goes back to why she found a role in daytime TV to be a more of a natural fit than being a reporter. And the things that she did, removing barriers between her and the interview guest, having people on her couch as opposed to sitting in these types of chairs in these more structured type of setting, going into the audience and them questions, getting them involved. And even though Oprah was known as a celebrity, probably one of the most recognizable people, she always made it a point to seem like she was one of you. In a way where celebrities often seem so different, Oprah could be your mom, could be your aunt. She was someone that was just like the viewer.
Absolutely. There was this layer of formality that was not necessary and in some ways an impediment. But in an era where news was delivered from a neutral point of view and less opinion was injected into it, the extra layers of formality served to underscore that. But as the world changed, there was an opening. Oprah was this transitional figure who was able to have that almost reality-like familiarity without being trashy reality TV, right? She really made you feel like you were watching a real person, not just a celebrity. And that was her appeal.
Right. She was able to toe that line that you were talking about because she involved the audience. She often took on wild subjects and got into it, whether it was having members of the Klan that were on her show. But it wasn't as salacious as Ricky Lake. It wasn't as trashy as Jerry Springer. She was still able to do it and still rise above a lot of that.
Ricky Lake, side note, went to my high school and I had her global studies textbook. It just, they passed on the textbook from year to year. And I got mine and in the back it says whose book it is for that year. And it's Ricky Lake, Hastings on Hudson High School.
Wow. Okay,
that's interesting.
Yeah. Small world. She was pretty young when she had that show.
I think so. So well, I think it was early 90s. Good for Ricky Lake. Anyway, back to Oprah.
Yeah. But it was really impressive how she was able to do that and toe that line. And one of the things, too, that did become a central theme with Oprah was her weight. She had lost 60 plus pounds in 1988, and she had that featured on the show talking about what she did and the dieting. She said she later seemed to regret that because her weight became a common tabloid talking point and contributed to a lot of the discussion and culture around weight loss and slim fast in the 90s and how they talked about celebrities. And that became a bit of a following thing for her, even more recently with whether it's her partnerships with Weight Watchers or how she's talked about Ozempic and speaking about influence, just how there's certain things that she's prided herself for having influence on, but there's other things that I know that she's questioned, how was that necessarily the best way to go about things? And it's obviously very different than how people talk about weight in 2024 as we're recording this now.
Interesting to see her involvement with Weight Watchers, and we can get into that more later in her portfolio as it expanded beyond TV and sort of visual media. But what an interesting way for her to take something that was attached to her in a way that was maybe not how she wanted it to be and parlay it into an equity stake in this company and help being involved in Weight Watchers, transition from Weight Watchers to like WW and more being a and living your best and healthiest life kind of thing, as opposed to focusing on the cringy stuff that we recall from 90s culture, fat shaming and so forth, which, you know, unfortunately is still around. At least we're making some progress here, but to take that and parlay it into equity, and I think is a really interesting and clever way of operating.
And it was something that was relative to her. And again, one of these things like makes her so relatable and why she really was truly unique in that type of way. if there's any decade that I think Oprah probably really resonated the strongest, I think she made even more money in the 2000s than she did in the 90s and maybe even in the 2010s. But I think especially the 90s felt like it was her decade. Some of the most iconic interviews that she had in the 90s. We should probably talk a bit about her Michael Jackson interview in 1993, because not only do the stats show that was one of her biggest interviews ever, but might be the biggest interview ever. I saw that there were over 60 million concurrent viewers of the interview and over 90 million overall. You're talking Super Bowl numbers for an interview.
You just took my line. Super Bowl numbers, that's exactly what it was. She had this unique power to get the numbers, but I think part of it was that she was able to get big celebrities like Michael Jackson to sit down with her. She was able to get the audience that wanted to see her anyway, and then they knew that she was going to deliver somebody like that. And let's remember, part of it is that in those days, celebrities did not have personal megaphones that they have now through social media. If you wanted to put something out and reach as many people as you couldn't just go on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram and TikTok, there was no megaphone bigger than Oprah. And if you were going to launching an album or a movie or trying to change the narrative, Oprah was Twitter before Twitter, right?
I have some stats on the people that appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show the most. If you have to guess,
all right,
which person appeared on the show the most, who would you guess? I'll give you a hint and say it's a musician. Like
Dr. Phil?
Oh, that doesn't count.
He was a protege.
We do need to talk about the people that she put on as being part of it, but I'll give you a hint. This is a popular singer in the 90s.
Whitney Houston.
Oh, not even in the top 15, which is interesting.
Ah!
But in the same group of artists, though, number one is Celine Dion. 27 times. That's an average of more than once per year. And if we're just thinking about the time that Celine Dion was popular, like that popular, you're talking three times a year, twice a year. That's crazy.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Good for Celine Dion for figuring out where to go to get the exposure. Jeez.
I know. Others that are up here, Chris Rock was on 26 times, Halle Berry 22, Mariah Carey 22, Patti LaBelle 22, Julia Roberts 21. Wild. People went and they came.
I guess once you see the effect that it can have on whatever it is that you're releasing, then you want to go back every time you release something.
It's like for all the effort that people put into these promo runs now, where they're like, oh, let's go on Kimmel, let's go on Hot Ones, let's go sneaker shopping with Complex. Just put me on Oprah and I'm good.
Yeah, and I'm done.
Let's take a break for a Chartmetric stat of the week. In 2009, when the Oprah Winfrey Show was still on air, Variety wrote about how Michael Bublé moved up the release date for his album Crazy Love in order to line up with the appearance slot that he got on the Oprah Show. Crazy Love is an album that today is still on at least 65,000 playlists on Spotify. So when we talk about Oprah's influence and the Oprah effect, think about how artists nowadays will move their release dates around so they don't compete against Drake or they don't compete against Taylor Swift or Adele. Back then, people were moving their release dates to line up with appearances on Oprah. That's how serious the Oprah effect and the influence is. Wild. Let's get back to the episode. You mentioned Dr. Phil earlier, so we should talk about the people that Oprah helped create in terms of their careers as well, because they were often featured as experts. Dr. Phil, Dr. Oz, Susie Orman, and then your best friend, Gayle King, who was also regular and in that orbit as well. She put on a lot of people in the same way that at the end of Drake's Pound Cake, Jay-Z's talking about Dame made millions, Jay made millions, Lior made millions. Oprah did the same.
It's really critical to mention how much Oprah was able to elevate people in her orbit. And I noticed that at Forbes. I was the media and entertainment editor over there. I joined after Forbes had already pronounced Oprah the first Black woman to become a billionaire, and that was back in 2003. And I started a few years after that. But eventually I came to oversee the celebrity list, and you would see her proteges on there, like Dr. Phil, and Oprah was always number one on this list. And I remember, I think she had been number one. I don't even remember how many years in a row. Is she just going to be number one for forever? This is the most boring thing, but we didn't have to worry about it forever because she eventually went to start OWN, and that kind of changed her economics and her annual earnings. And so she wasn't number one every year anymore. But just to give you a sense of like the continued dominance of her earnings, she was earning nine figures every year for I don't even know how many years in a row. And the consistency and the magnitude were just like off the charts.
Massive. I look at her, I look at Seinfeld, I look at these other people who made their billions from the economic landscape that existed in the 90s and the 2000s for having an extremely popular show on broadcast networks.
Yeah, the power of syndication. Maybe we're going to look back at the big Netflix deal era a few decades from now, and we're going to think about the same way. Oh, these people who had the in, who had the specific juice that was needed to get a big Netflix deal.
We should also talk about the Oprah effect with Oprah's book club, because the massive success that thing had is impressive. Oprah wasn't the first person to have a book club, but again, we started this conversation talking about whether Oprah is the biggest and the most influential influencer because of things like the book club. So as I mentioned, she starts it in 1996, runs it 15 plus years, recommended 70 books total from the book club, was able to drive 30 million copies sold of these books, and responsible for generating $130 million worth of revenue from that book club. And that was just in the first year. It's a little bit difficult to determine, okay, did this directly come from Oprah? Does it not directly come from Oprah? But you can't deny the influence.
Having written numerous books, I can tell you without a doubt that being in Oprah's book club is like the biggest possible thing. It is the holy grail. It's bigger than any celebrity retweet. Or if you get your book in Oprah's book club, you are set. Like, you're going to have a bestseller. You're going to get another book deal. I can't even think of an equivalent in music. Maybe it's like Dr. Dre producing your whole album. It is unfathomable the kind of impact it could have. And just like the reverence within publishing that Oprah's book club has whispered about, like this godly thing that could happen. And you really can't expect it. But if it happens, it's going to change it.
When you had written books, was there a big push by your publishers or anyone with you to be like, all right, we can try to get on this stuff, but we really got to get on this list?
I think with Oprah in particular, it's just such a revered and rarefied thing that you don't even talk about it, right? If you are blowing up to a certain level and if you have a certain kind of book, then maybe you have a chance. I think there's also a limited amount of political capital at every publishing house, and they're only going to use their asks on a certain number of books per year. You want to make the New York Times bestseller list. That's like the standard big thing. And you can get on there, I think, these days by selling 10,000 books in a week if it's the right week and the right bookstores, because the list is, it's got this strange methodology where online sales are different from in person, and independent bookstores count more than Barnes & Noble. But then you factor in ebook sales, there's a little bit of mystique around it, and nobody knows exactly the ratios and stuff, and it maybe changes. Everybody tries to make that happen and goes out and has their friends buy their books at indie bookstores. But one Oprah book club appearance is like, all that's guaranteed. You said
Obama's book club is probably the closest one that I hear when someone mentions it nowadays, but I don't see the impact numbers from that. And that probably says less about Obama and just more about the media climate of 2024, as opposed to the way it was in 2004 or 1996. But I'm sure that's likely just a fraction.
Yeah, there's only one Oprah. One of one, right?
Yep, one of one. Exactly. And with that, we should continue to talk about the Oprah effect, because some of the guests that she has on can also have big swings in politics, for instance. So the first time that she had political guests on the show was 2000. She agreed to have both George W. Bush and Al Gore on the show. And if you read the polling at the time, the two were pretty much neck and neck before they appeared on the show. Al Gore goes on the show, and he's pretty much Al Gore, straight to the point. One of the criticisms about him for years, not as much personality there. Meanwhile, George Bush goes on the show, energetic, goes in, shaking hands, kissing, and really doing the Clinton at Arsenio Hall, and the polling for George W. Bush goes much higher after that. Who knows? There could have been other factors. Obviously, there's a lot going on, and that was probably one of the craziest elections that we've ever had in the U.S., but that was one of the first times that people started to see the influence of Oprah and politics there. But then it goes to a whole nother level in 2008 with Obama. But even before 2008, as early as 2006, Obama's a Chicago guy. Oprah is also from Chicago as well. They start to connect. I'm sure she was pretty tapped in, especially after his 2004 DNC speech. And she's the one that says pretty much on record, hey, are you going to announce this? This is before he even announced that he was running for president. But back in 06, where there's a lot of speculation. So he then says that he announces his candidacy in 2007, she publicly endorses him and supports him. And people have went back and look at the stats to look at the Obama voter turnout and then comparing that to the places that have subscriptions to the O magazine. And people that analyzed it did say that, yes, we noticed an uptick in places where there was a considerable number of O magazine subscriptions, comparing that to counties that voted a particular way for Obama, even when they controlled for different factors. So they were able to quantify the Oprah effect on the 2008 presidential election.
It's such an authentic connection. They're both not necessarily from Chicago, but Chicago is their adopted home and what have you. And some of the barriers that they both had to break through. And there's nothing like authenticity to make that kind of connection really pop. Going back to the Bush and Gore example, though, that was the twilight of the idea of that you could have neutrality. After that was, we saw the Fox News era, the MSNBC era, and this idea that commentators and TV personalities were going to be neutral started to go out the window. And as you've seen over the years, she's getting more involved in Democratic causes, and there's been speculation of her on and off running for president. It's no coincidence that Obama is now moving more into some of the spaces that Oprah has occupied, whether it's the book club or the production deals.
Her continued influence on different people in their careers really started to pick up. You see it with Tyler Perry and Tyler Perry Studios and them working together with the O Network, which we'll get into. But you also see it in people like Issa Rae or Reese Witherspoon, how they're building their companies, or Will and Jada with Westbrook, or LeBron James with Spring Hill. Oprah is the model. They've clearly adapted things for the current era, but everyone's just looking at how is she able to navigate this, make this happen. She set the blueprint for so much of that. Even things, her influence even expanded in things that I didn't even realize, even as early as UGG boots and products like that, where she was early to endorse in the 2000s, and then by the mid-2000s really become this thing. That traces back to Oprah. The influence is crazy.
Yeah, and I think one of the fascinating parts is that she's the model, especially from a business perspective, and there's a lot of people trying to pop up and be the next Oprah. She did it in the time that was the peak time to do it, right, to do this particular thing, particularly as concerns syndication and honing the rights to these sorts of this sort of content. And we can talk about the equivalents of Netflix or other sorts of deals that can occur these days, but she really did the thing at the peak of the thing in a certain type of way. And so it's almost like, it's almost not possible to recapture what she did because you can't also recapture that era. And if you look at what happened when she started her own network, Oprah Winfrey Network Own, as we alluded to, you wouldn't call it a failure, but it was not as successful, at least in terms of the bottom line for her, as she had been before.
Even Oprah couldn't replicate Oprah in the new era.
Right.
Just exactly. A quick timeline, a couple points there. As you mentioned, she starts Own Network, and Own Network was started as a JV between Harpo, her production studios, and Discovery. 50-50 ownership between the two of them. A bit more unique for Oprah, this is a new path, and this was her starting a cable network. And she ends the show, the Oprah Winfrey Show, in 2011. Her team cited, some of them felt like they're working 24 hours a day, just getting a bit tired of the format. And 2010, 2011, there was definitely a changing of the guard in terms of broadcast TV in general. People knew that cord cutting was going to become a thing. So it made sense to move on from there. But as you put it, it was just a little bit tough to have the own network, her own cable channel, replicate a lot of that. And one of the things that Oprah spoke about specifically with why it was so difficult was the habit. And she underestimated the habit that people had to just be able to turn on the TV at 4 o'clock and see her on the TV. It's a little bit harder when she's one of these cable channels and she has all this different type of programming and she's trying to take a bit of a backseat but feature others. The network had lost $226 million in the first couple of years. Granted, a lot of that was put into upfront programming, but still, it really wasn't until she made the deal with Tyler Perry Studios to get a few of his shows on the network, both syndicated and run there, that things started to be in the black for her. And the network was reportedly profitable by 2013. But again, there were some changes that had happened along the way where in 2017, Discovery bought 24.5% stake. for $70 million. And then they bought another stake in 2020 that gave them a 95% ownership of the network. And it's not like the percentage of the revenue that they were getting it for was a much higher number than it was necessarily before. Again, still successful. If it was any of the people that we mentioned besides Oprah, would have been great news. But relatively speaking, it's less money than what Oprah and Harpo Studios was pulling in a year from the Oprah Winfrey Show. And Oprah still had and still has tremendous influence even in the 2010s, but the media side just wasn't as lucrative.
Yeah, if anybody had a career path and ended up selling their company for a couple hundred million dollars, that's like an amazing story. I think there's a couple things here. One, again, it's just the timing of media consumption habits, right? She started in 2008, it's dawn of the social media era, and we're talking about a cable network. And then there was a few years there, though, where she didn't put her own show on OWN, right? It was still the prior arrangement. And it's hard to want to give that up when you're making all that money and whatever, but it's also hard to make OWN really pop and really be a must-have thing when the main piece of content is elsewhere. And I think that's the problem that you've seen with everybody other than Netflix, right? Even Disney, like there was a time where the rumor is Disney going to buy Netflix? Right? And then it could be Disneyflix. Imagine if they'd done that. They waited a little too long to launch Disney Plus in the way that they did. Same goes for some of these other IP holders. And as for Oprah, if it had been like, I'm taking everything to OWN, starting in 2008, she might've caught the tail end of a different part of being an editor at Forbes at the time. And we were all waiting to see what happened, how that would impact her earnings. But by the time she finally took her show over several years later, I think she lost some momentum and it was beginning to be even more of a different era. Not that it's been a failure. It hasn't been as lucrative as her prior arrangement.
A bit of it was a misread in those early years of understanding what people wanted, because what people wanted was to still watch Oprah Winfrey on TV. And she had held that out for a little bit. She eventually brought it through, as you mentioned, but that was the habit that they wanted. And in some of these other streaming services, I agree, because we saw this play out even with Oprah's deal with Apple. So she was part of that early launch with all of the stars. Steven Spielberg was up there. That's when they had first announced The Morning Show. They had Reese Witherspoon. So they had all the Hollywood A-listers that were being like, hey, we're behind this. Apple has the war chest. Apple is going to help make this happen. But they came into the game so late that even if you fast forward to the way things are today, Apple TV Plus has amazing and great shows, but a lot of them barely get watched or barely get noticed, not because they're not good, but because they're on Apple TV Plus and because they're not on Netflix, because Netflix has been doing this longer than everyone else. They have the distribution. Going back to that habit piece, people are used to going to Netflix to see the stuff they want. That's why these other networks are selling their own shows be on Netflix as well. Max has a lot of content that they're putting on Netflix because they realize that's where the juices, that's where the eyeballs, whether it's shows like Cobra Kai or others, or even Suits, they get a whole new second life once they're on Netflix for that same type of reason. And just going back a little bit to the deal that Oprah had with Apple TV, this was a non-exclusive big deal that she signed in 2018. It included the book club or TV show. There were going to be Oprah conversations and documentaries, but that deal ended in 2022, and there wasn't that much that came from it. If anything, the more noteworthy things that Oprah's done in her career the past 5+ years have been outside of that Apple TV deal. It's two things I think of. It's the interview that she had done with Meghan and Harry, where she had said, were you silent or were you silenced? And that again was just classic Oprah, knowing the exact way to frame something and just building that trust immediately. And then the Adele interview that she had done right around the time that Adele had released the 30 album. I think that was in 2021. Those were the big things that she had done. And I think, again, Oprah still, if we're looking at the numbers, probably had one of the most watched interviews of the 2020s so far with either of those. So she continues that streak. So she's picking her moments clearly, but we're just in such a different landscape than we are now.
Yeah. And again, back to the megaphone piece, right? It's these stars don't necessarily need that megaphone. There just aren't that many big interviews. Big interviews aren't really a thing anymore in the way that they were. And yeah, she's doing as much of that as anyone. Stars have their own megaphones, and Tom Cruise can jump on his own couch and put it on wherever he wants. It's just a different world.
Here's a question. Do you think there was part of Oprah that looks at the nine figures that Joe Rogan gets from Spotify, and not one of these nine-figure deals that just came and went and nothing came from it, like actually earning the money because so many people are listening to him. And looking at that and being like, I used to be that person in the 90s and the 2000s. I used to be the person. And looking at his money, or even looking at the Howard Stern piece and knowing that she's still fine, she's doing her thing, but at least from the influence perspective, is there part of her that's like, all right, I still wish that I had that level of influence right now in today's era?
I think it's hard to imagine Oprah sitting at her mansion in Montecito being like, God, I wish I had more anything. And I think she has so much influence. It would be hard to really think about wanting more, and so much money that it'd be hard to think about wanting more. But yeah, to your point, could she have been Joe Rogan in that medium? Like, could she have been the Oprah equivalent?
Right. Could she be a top 10 podcaster?
Yeah. Instead of launching OWN, she had just gone straight to podcasts, and that was her thing, and that was going to be her medium. Maybe, but with her, there's like these visuals of comfort, and you're sitting on her couch, and it's just this like whole thing. It's a little bit different. And I think also successful podcasters have to be like a little more irreverent. And certainly Oprah was different from the sort of buttoned up formality of television back in the day. She's not as off the cuff and certainly not as profane as some of these big podcasters. And the level of informality has gone up another step. Yeah, I think she was the perfect person for the medium that she came up in. And she's really great in any medium, but I don't know that she would have been quite as astronomically successful in another medium.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction about podcasting too, because I'm thinking about the most popular podcast that reached women, a show like Call Her Daddy, which takes that to a whole nother level in terms of just the informality and the subject matter and the things they talk about. The way that media is set up right now, a lot of the top people in broadcast are pretty much around that 20 million a year mark. There's very few, unless you're truly owning the show, like a podcast or something like that, that are really doing more than that. I'm thinking about like a Stephen A. Smith type deal at ESPN, or like a Norm O'Donnell at CBS, or Troy Aikman and Joe Buck, or any of those people, or even Tom Brady. That's pretty much what they make. And that's chump change in a lot of ways to Oprah Winfrey.
I'd be really interested to compare those numbers to the inflation adjusted numbers of 20 years ago. Is the difference due to the personality, or is it due to the medium? Back when the television side of things was the main part of the game, was there proportionally more money to attach to some of the big stars that were involved? I think probably yes, but I'd have to go back and run some numbers.
Yeah, I would agree too. We should talk about though, before we close things out, do you have a meme or Oprah moment that she's probably the most synonymous for?
Oh, yeah. I think it's you get a car and you get a car and you get a car, right? If you could, that's the first thing that pops into my head. That's iconic. There are now commercials that play off of that for other products that are not cars, right? It's so iconic that I think it's one of those things that our kids are going to look at and they're just going to think it's something somebody says and not even know that it was an Oprah thing. It's that much part of the culture.
Yeah, you get a car is probably the biggest one. I'd also mention her scene in The Color Purple in the cornfield that you always see come up. And she spoke about that as well, and just the influence there with Quincy Jones and the relationship. There's that quote where I think maybe actually was Barbara Walters that asked her about her relationship with Gayle King, and she's brought to tears and she's like, I don't know a better person. That whole friendship, anytime I had a tough time, if I wasn't talking to Stedman Graham, her partner, she was talking to Gayle King about it. From a light note, it's either you get a car, or Tom Cruise jumping on the couch.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good point. Yeah. The jumping on the couch, I think, might be a more iconic Tom Cruise moment than an Oprah moment. And maybe that's good for Oprah. It was like, it's like pretty weird. But no, would it have become a meme for being weird if it weren't on Oprah?
Probably not in the same way. And then there was also the piece with Ellen, too, where Ellen came out, although technically I think that was on Ellen's own show. And then Oprah was like playing like a guest like person, but pretty much being herself on the Ellen show at the time in the late 90s. But that kind of counts because Oprah's in the same thing, but it wasn't technically on the Oprah Winfrey show. But that was an iconic moment where Oprah did talk about a lot of the hate mail and a lot of the disappointing feedback that she got at the time. Obviously, it was a very different climate for Ellen to do it in the way she did, but for Oprah to be part of it as well.
Yeah, that's another great one. A really great point about how Oprah's on the forefront. And I think, especially given the places where Oprah grew up and some of the sort of preconceived notions and prejudices around sexuality, like, I think an especially impressive platform for her to give.
For sure. Indeed. Before we close things out, anything else on the one of one, Oprah Winfrey?
We were talking a lot about the decision to start OWN and how she launched it and how she took a few years to get her main thing over there. It actually reminds me a little bit of Jay-Z, right, with Tidal. And it was such a great idea a couple of years too late, and they didn't quite have the main things available on the service. And by the time they did, it didn't quite matter as much. We've been talking about Oprah and Obama a lot. I would probably compare it to Jay-Z. I think they're both worth about $3 billion. Lift other people up who've been their protégés, had that next step, the ownership, had this big thing that was almost even bigger. But I think also just like a willingness, they're obviously both incredible entrepreneurs, but realize that you can be even more successful having partners. And that's part of being an entrepreneur. It's not just, you have to know the value of ownership, but part of the value of ownership is knowing when to give some of it up to make your life easier, a smaller piece of a much bigger pie, which is overall bigger for you. Obviously, they have like different demeanors and paths and all that, but you know, functionally, the destination business-wise and some of the steps and some of the philosophies, you know, you could see a little bit of overlap, but they're still both one of one.
Oprah operates more as a person that launched a very successful company. And if we're looking at Harpo Productions and in connection, the Oprah Winfrey Show, as this company that had an incredible 25-year run, and she tries to do something else, and the economics of the environment changed a little bit. Like we said, it wasn't a complete failure, but quite different than does the Apple deal. And that's a little bit different as well, but she still has these things. That's what makes these people unique. I feel like every person that we've talked about in the series and that we will has had their setbacks. And Oprah probably has less of them relative to other people, just considering how long that epic run was. But that's what makes these people unique. It's being able to look through and pull back and go, okay, what made this one work? What made that one not work? And the way that she just set things up from that 1983 to 1988 range set her up for life. And incredible timing, and she was able to capture the next 2+ decades as a result.
Yeah, 100%. The whole point of this series, One of Ones, is like advice that entrepreneurs can apply to their own journeys and that sort of thing. There are things that Oprah has done that are just not really replicable. Some of it you can take bits and pieces and add to your own entrepreneurial story, but sometimes you just have to sit back and be like, wow, that was a one of one thing. That's Oprah.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks, Zach. This was fun. Appreciate you coming on.
Yes, absolutely. Always a blast.
If you enjoy this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.